You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and you are listening to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist concerning the intersection of Orthodox theology, especially Russian Orthodox theology, the concept of ethnicity, the nation, and international politics. As always, I want to thank my donors, whether it be on Patreon or direct donations or whatever. Since I depend on you guys to function. Today I want to deal with rhetoric and poetics. And I want to get into this for two reasons. I should say several reasons. A lot of what Plato and Aristotle had to say about rhetoric and poetics has a lot to do with propaganda, especially Plato. I think an educated man has to be able to interpret literature, has to be able to understand the elements and things like tragedy. And of course, for both Plato and Aristotle, these were very social. You know, everything affects everything else. And so when Plato uses the word poetry, he's talking about everything. And he tends to conflate, you know, he uses rhetoric and poetics similarly. Sometimes Aristotle does that, but he has two separate books on it. And I'm going to start with Aristotle only because he has systematic treatises on it connected to everything else. Plato doesn't. Plato has these scattered all over the Republic. It's the subject of the Ion, a very early one. It's in the Phaedrus. Quite a bit. It's in the Gorgias. It comes up over and over again, but not as a matter of, that doesn't have its own separate work. So reflecting the world around you is inherently social. Propaganda fits into this perfectly, for better or for worse. So Aristotle starts off by talking about the nature of character. And that characters are themselves imitations. And it's natural for us to recapitulate and interpret the social world. If you write any piece of drama, the characters have to be, have some reality. Even if it's, you know, purely mythic, they have to be actual human beings with problems. The drama, the tragedy especially, is about people who are very similar to us, maybe a little bit better. Comedy is usually, at least at the time, about people who are a little bit less than us, morally speaking. Aristotle talks about tragedy. Tragedy doesn't have a happy ending, but it's based on a single plot. There's a tightly bound time, usually one day. And there's also a unity of place. Place becomes an important issue afterwards. And the purpose, among a few other things, of tragedy, which Aristotle spends most of his time talking about, is to evoke pity and fear. And those two things then purge. Remember, these plays, what he's talking about in terms of poetics, these were public events. These were public and highly political and religious interpretations of, you know, Homer and Hesiod, whatever. And it goes back to the myths of time. The Greek word is catharsis. And it's not so much an elimination of these negative emotions, but it's a proper purification of their emotions. we can see lessons learned on characters who suffer misfortune without actually suffering misfortune. So that's the introduction. Characters are central because this is what we're recapitulating or imitating. And he advocates that it needs to be a closed story. There's no serial tragedies in Aristotle's world. The word Greek word tragedy actually means goat song. So the concept of goat being connected with something awful goes back even before Aristotle, and it has an unhappy ending. The plot also has to be of great importance. It can't be trivial. I mean, comedy can be trivial. Tragedy is not. And it's the interplay of fortune and misfortune. Fortune leading to misfortune. Now, while the plays of his day were historical in the sense that they were mythic, it isn't history. These things haven't literally happened, but we know that a million variations have already happened. History is studying what has been, while poetry, poetics, tragedy is talking about what should be. Poetics, again, a very broad concept, because everything was written in verse. Tragedy and comedy was, you know, written by poets. These were a much broader set of disciplines. I mean, it is a productive science in both Plato and Aristotle's world. And what they produced is emotion and understanding. The tragedy is based around a certain level of unexpected events, but not outside of the logical order. And it centers around two things. Peripeteia, which means a reversal of fortune. Someone who's doing very well loses everything. Anamnesis is the second, and that's a discovery or recognition of something that derives directly from the reversal of fortune. Suffering is essential for at least the hero. And plots can be, well, in tragedy, shouldn't be all that complex. But misery, rather than tragedy, is never the goal here. That's not the feeling that a tragedy wants to leave. There's no blatantly evil men in any of these. But if a bad man is depicted, he cannot be depicted as happy, or even having been happy at one point. Aristotle and Plato have a huge problem with connecting evil behavior to any kind of happiness, which is something that moderns don't worry about. And gangs, especially non-white ones, are presented as romanticized figures. So the reversal of fortune is what brings about the discovery. The hamartia is the error in judgment which causes the downfall. It's an error in judgment, but in a sense of some sort of a tragic flaw. And this is something that evokes pity. Pity is our reaction to undeserved and unearned pain and suffering. The way Aristotle talks about a plot in structuring these tragedies, and this goes for political mythology, this goes for everything that we talk about on the show, there's one issue involved. It's got to be focused. Fortune goes to misfortune, but not the reverse. The misfortune is from an error in judgment. The hero should be basically good. They're you know, not directly bad people. But Aristotle says the hero should be flawed, but not too flawed, certainly not perfect, and not exceptionally flawed. But the hero himself, and we come across this almost every minute of every day, the stories, how they talk about Martin Luther King, how they talk about Adolf Hitler. The regime, when they try to put a narrative together, is so clumsy and ham-handed, and is often not the language of the common, especially the common white man in America and elsewhere. But the hero has to be good. There is a moral purpose behind his actions. And those good qualities have to be an integral part of his character, not artificially tacked on. That has to be realistic, relatable. And the hero has to be consistent. So it isn't so much just we're talking about, you know, what an ancient Greek tragedy is. These are the ingredients to a story of any kind, including all the myths and stories that moderns tell themselves. Any kind of inconsistency has to be explained in the text. And that the hero himself has to be unified. He has to be a single cell. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but social media is saturated with motivational talks and things. Jordan Peterson, who I just roll my eyes at, this man has never said anything that isn't blatantly obvious. I don't know how he ever got where he got. But we're talking about the heroic ethos, especially for white males, being deliberately removed. But it's precisely in this suffering that a discovery is made, a recognition. And that can happen in a few different ways. It can be the unearthing of a symbol of some kind, an unearthing in a literal and metaphorical way. It could be something added by the author, an improbable act, which Aristotle doesn't like. It could be something from a memory, especially a distant memory. It could be from his own reason, something along the lines of Sherlock Holmes. Logic that's faulty, but nevertheless leads to an important discovery. And that they naturally, the recognition naturally flows from events. You simply learn how the other half lives. Aristotle uses the term spectacle in English, translated in English, and it refers to the setting, and including the place, how the stage is set up. Now, what Aristotle's doing here with all of this, we're talking about the connection between poetry and rhetoric. This is about persuasion. Now, today, everything is based around leftist ideology. Everything has to promote one aspect of it or another. So it's very ham-handed, very forced. You know, they have to have a gay character and they shoehorn them in somehow, whatever it is. It, you know, violates all of this and is often very bad entertainment and the same thing for the Soviet model, because the U.S. and the Soviet Union are very, very similar. These are very clunky. You know, you have to watch everything you say. The two Greek terms, deesis and lusis. Deesis is a complication. It's the Greek for being tied up. It's what happens after the collapse. And lusis is everything from the catastrophe onward. It means untying, coming to the solution. So all of this has to do with persuasion in one way or another. Catharsis is a social matter. Some of the pent-up negative feelings can be released when we see it released in front of us. This stuff has a profound effect. Ritual does, and a lot of these things were quite ritualized. So the beginning has a certain level of fortune and power. The middle is some kind of a collapse, and then finally, the discovery. Untying himself. He's learned something about himself that motivates him. And that's how he gets out of the problem. This is how someone is persuaded to have a certain emotion. For Aristotle, pity and fear, again, very broad things, partially because we are just surrounded by unearned suffering. So let me summarize this so far. Poetics is mimesis, that is to say, an imitation, a recapitulation. Aristotle says that's a part of human nature, is using these examples. And maybe, because of their persuasiveness, they can create a knowledge or an understanding far better than a lecture like this can. Actually, we'll talk about that here in a second. The term myth is used a lot as a second element. That's the plot in the background. That's the background place. The assumptions that are built into how the plot goes. And of course, catharsis itself, deriving from the release of pity and fear. But the root of the word myth is an unfolding. It's very similar to something like logos. The word development, word of mouth. And all this stuff, remember, was spoken and recited or sung and had tremendous social and political importance. This is the nature of persuasiveness. I did a lecture on Plato's Gorgias, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, concerning this very topic. Rhetoric and poetics on the one hand, kind of doing some of the same things, and reality on the other. Plato is far harsher on poetics than Aristotle is. But both make the claim that there's a certain production. There's a certain labor here. Ethics produces knowledge on human conduct. The sciences produce knowledge on truths for their own sake. Rhetoric and poetics, it's the means of persuasion. The knowledge, because this is a very social thing. How do you get people to function as a unified body? I know rhetoric and poetics are dissimilar in a lot of ways, but they really have a similar function. Rhetoric is more directly political and social, while the tragic is literary, but the overlap is tremendous. One of the main ways that the regime promotes its ideology is through entertainment, usually very bad entertainment. Entertainment, music, all of this, which all would be included, I guess, as poetics, and to a lesser extent, rhetoric. Rhetoric normally is a matter of a politician, but not necessarily. Well, there's three rhetorical situations Aristotle talks about. The deliberative, which is the character of the speaker talking about future events. In other words, if we keep doing this, we're going to end up here. The forensic. This is, you know, the constitution. This is the audience. This is a preaching of a certain set of assumptions. And juridical, dealing with justice and injustice. That's normally these things that are done in a courtroom. These, of course, were omnipresent in ancient Greece, although in a very different form. They are everywhere in the postmodern world, where in fact, that's all that exists, are these characters and the fashions that they promote. And this is one of the reasons why these arts today have collapsed entirely, like everything else. The thing is, rhetoric or poetic don't posit their own goal. In a way, these are only tools, and Plato will take great issue with that. That has to come from philosophy. But what is something that's tragic? And our people are surrounded by this every single day. Now, this is a complete story. It has to be, by the way, again, very significant, very powerful, very grave. But it also has to be based around pleasant imagery. I mean, you have to maintain your attention, and this is the realm of metaphor. In the ancients, metaphor and simile were very similar. And there's four of these. from the universal to the particular. A general term is used in place of the specific one. So you could refer to, you know, your paycheck as your reward. The gold in your pocket, well, it's not literally gold in your pocket. It's a far more general term than just dollars and cents. And of course, then the reverse, the specific to the general. A specific word is used in place of a general one. So Congress is a general term because it has both houses. The House and the Senate are specific ones. So if you simply say Congress, yes, you're talking about the same things, although it's less precise. And then species to species, that is to say, specific to specific. One term is used in place of another, very similar to a what we use by the term metaphor. Like that Albanian woman called me a dog. Well, I'm not literally one, but she wants to transfer some of that to me. And then the metaphor from analogy. You know, your room is so messy, it's like a tornado went through here. That's very similar to a simile. But because all of us are intensely flawed, that is what carries the language along. Language, as you know, is extremely political and social, since that is the basis of ethnicity. All of these terms were referred to as public labor and productive labor. Moderns see productive labor as just something that could be sold on the market. That certainly wasn't the case for the ancients or the medievals. It is the production of anything that wasn't there before. And finally, the tragic goes on its own motion. The characters are pushing it along. You don't need a narrator. Epic poetry needs a narrator. Narrators can be very irritating. And you want to focus on the characters, and the characters push things around. Aristotle, unlike Plato, will say that poetry, and this is excluding rhetoric, is more philosophical, more momentous, more universal, because it explores the meaning of words, and it deals with emotions, especially the right emotions. Again, this is where Plato gets very upset. The audience ultimately is a subject. That's me and you. Now, that's the subject of what's happening. They are the target of all of this. The emotion is the matter, since this is what aesthetics really is for. All of this can come under the aesthetic heading. Pity and fear for the tragic, etc. And the purge, or the cathartic. And I shouldn't use the word purge. It's more of a purification. It's cleansing the emotions. No one wants to eliminate them. It's a purification rather than a purge. Ultimately, it all comes down to imitation. Mimesis, again, it's more than, it's not a copy of something, but it's a realistic portrayal of something such that your story can proceed in a way that's relatable. And oftentimes, you know, especially the sitcom, these are very Jewish, and so they're always urban, often either New York or LA or something like that, and most people don't live there. Most of entertainment these days doesn't make money, but that's not the point. This has to be taken as the new normal. This is one of the reasons why the average white male is in serious psychological trouble. So we're talking about a depiction. We're talking about a depiction is, by its definition, an interpretation. So it's easy to confuse rhetoric and poetics, but we could bring them all under aesthetics, because this stuff has to be beautiful in the ancient sense of the term. Now, to focus just on rhetoric, which is almost a branch of poetics, we're talking now about a speaker. Let's picture a lawyer and closing argument addressing the jury, or a politician on television addressing the nation as a whole, or something like that. We're talking about persuasion. People need to be persuaded of something. So, the speaker, whoever this might be, has to have a certain intelligence and certain competence. Again, this is something else that Plato's going to make a big deal out of. Because we're talking about why would people believe somebody? Why would you believe me or anyone like that? The character has to be virtuous. He cannot be an evil man. And we're not talking about fiction here. We're talking about day-to-day life, political and legal. And he has to at least be perceived as having a good will. Emotions, for all of this, are meant to motivate, to purify, to create a consensus where none existed before. But we all know that bad arguments not only are often persuasive, but depending on how they're stated, bad arguments can be accepted long before a proper argument is. But this all goes within a context, and this is the payoff here. Enthymema, it's a Greek term. Again, it is not really an English corresponding term. It's about the context in which a demonstration or an argument makes sense. It's the general scheme of proof. Now, there's a truth to tragedy as well as a truth to rhetoric, and essentially they have the same aim. That when you're talking about public speaking, and this can go within a play as well as a political speech, perfect logical rigor isn't expected. You can't get out there and talk like a computer and expect to get anywhere, no matter how right you are. But there's a body of persuasion, which is actually a better term. And it comes down to finding, if you disagree with your audience, if you suspect that there's going to be resistance, figure out what you all agree on. There's got to be a proposition where you all agree, like usually an end, a purpose. You know, something, you know, the innocent should not be punished, the guilty should be. Okay. Then you have to show how your, whatever your agenda is, whatever your story is, will lead to this end. This is a matter of practical deliberation. And there's a million ways to do this. But the dialectical approach is something that Aristotle mentions, and back then, not in a Hegelian sense today, of course, but back then, something that Plato did, where you take the received opinions and you set them against each other, and you see what elements they have in common, what you could take from it that makes sense. So a false demonstration gives the appearance of logic, the appearance of knowledge, the appearance of understanding. But there has to be something that's going to convince the audience, whether it be you as a man, so a former gang member talking about gangs, you're going to believe him. It could be the argument itself, that it's so logical, and if you dress it up in a certain way, it's going to be accepted, and there's fuzzy edges here. Or this basic agreement, touching on topics that the speaker and the crowd has in common. Probability, again, these aren't strictly scientific concepts, but probability is essential. This is a practical matter, not a scientific matter. Greek word topoi, or topos, concerns. We get the word topic from it. These are different aspects of deduction, part of any speech, whether it be in fiction or not. These are elements, the general scheme or patterns of thought that you have to tap into. So an argument from facts and logic, that is part of a topos. It also means a place from which to attack. Okay, well, you agree on this one thing. However broad it is, And then you start filling in the blanks for them. Now, that's becoming, as you know, more and more difficult, not just because of censorship, but because we have a population so bewildered and hypnotized that we don't know if they're comprehending anything at all. You always come across your sensitive people. I usually know that right away. But otherwise, it's getting more and more difficult. And especially the intense alienation. There's a literal falling apart of the most intelligent and the most productive element in society, that's white males. See how that turns out. You know, political issues. We talked about the, you know, deliberative kinds of rhetoric. Political, you can't really prove it. You need to be very careful. Proof is a logical matter. It's logical entailment by the very definitions of terms. In an empirical argument where you're gathering data and coming to conclusions, you can't say I've proven this. You say I suggest this is the proper language. But war and peace, taxation, well, there's no logical proof there. That's not even relevant. We're talking about what probably will work, what does history tell us, etc. And this can as easily be instantiated in fiction, tragedy, whatever, as it can be directly in politics. And I say this again because right now the regime is so alienated from us. They loathe us. They use people, but they're so alienated from us, they don't know what we think. Everything is an image. It's a simulacrum. You've seen my stuff on postmodernism. I say it because the way that the regime communicates to us is through entertainment, media in general. Rhetoric is a specific element within poetics and aesthetics. Anyway, the topos, this is the plan of attack. It could simply be a general instruction. Like a judge gives jury instructions to the jury. It could really be a scheme of argument. Here's how I'm going to approach this. It could be the assumption of a general rule or principle, which justifies the scheme of an argument. A general rule would be, you know, the most clearest one is logical, is contradiction. You can't contradict yourself. I mean, but that's pretty obvious. But the assumption that we're a community, you can't talk about the U.S. as a nation. There is no community. People are so alienated that that simply can't be done. Nothing is what it seems, and everything that the average normie thinks about the world is wrong. The other one is even more obvious, and that's an example. But of course, that also requires interpretation, and then the application. It rises and falls on the assumptions you make. And one of the great errors of so many otherwise decent writers is that they assume things and they don't realize they assume things. Teasing out the assumption from your argument is an extremely difficult skill to master. So we're talking about what action would be appropriate to the conclusion that we all want to bring about. The regime has no conception of the assumptions that it has, because they talk only amongst themselves. They have no access to any, you know, nationalist or royalist work. They have no idea it exists or what it says. So they simply assume that their little cult is reality. So they wouldn't even know how to answer us, except to throw us in prison. So when that's manifest in either rhetoric or fiction, it's almost a joke. Yeah, there's plenty of exceptions. It's usually so alien from us. All the pictures of multiracial, diverse groups of people, that's not reality. Everything is now biracial, and the mixing of races, that is to say, black and white. That's something, that homosexuality is normal and the same as a normal family. That men have nothing to complain about. that, you know, all these concepts that, you know, the public-private distinction is gone, but they're still going to use the same language. But I've already mentioned the concept of style. And this goes for everything. Lexis is the term. How should my argument be laid out? I think I have a very distinctive way of doing this personally. When I first started many, many years ago on podcast, radio, whatever, I didn't think that my style of lecturing would go over well. And I was wrong. I was flooded with email because it is a unique approach. There's no bells or whistles. I have no guests. If you have the attention span to listen, you're going to learn something. But how do I go about this? What kind of nouns are used? It can't be repetitive. It's got to be somewhat colorful and varied. You got to keep people's attention. My personality, of course, does that for me. The language can't be overly technical or overly dumbed down. And you have to make a decision. I use technical terms here all the time, but I tell you that they're technical terms and define them. It's a term that's used specifically in a field that's not the same way that same word is used in normal conversation. That's a big problem when talking about legal issues. The crime of harassment, say, it's not really a crime, but at least not in Pennsylvania. The crime of harassment, legally structured, isn't what we normally think harassment is. Those are two different uses of the word. Simile and metaphor we've already talked about. It's a way to relate one thing to another. Grammar is important. And that's really just a matter of credibility, the credibility of the speaker. Proper grammar suggests that you do know how to build an argument. Because arguments are similar to how grammar functions. And it has to be more or less clear, your purpose, your evidence, what you're going to describe. It has to be the appropriate length, given the occasion. Sometimes even the use of when I use the word rhetoric, I'm not necessarily talking about it in Aristotle's sense. Rhetoric meaning the use of elevated language. Language that may be somewhat inappropriate for what we're talking about. Ultimately, you want to create a vivid impression. Now, Aristotle will say that rhetoric is needed to express the truth. Plato has a problem with this. We'll get to that in a second. That rhetoric is most useful for contingent things. War and peace, taxation, whether or not someone's guilty. Emotions are secondary, but that doesn't mean they're not very important. The speaker has to be able to defend himself intellectually. He can't simply spout memorized slogans. So something is persuasive when it's worthy of credence. Emotion is used properly. So you see the significance here. Whether it be persuasion in fiction or persuasion in political legal rhetoric, these are tremendously overlapping. Now, Plato, of course, who came before Aristotle. Aristotle was a student of Plato. Plato doesn't make a whole... He actually refuses to make a distinguish between rhetoric and poetics. Fiction, history, whatever. If it relies on the manner of its expression, he has a problem with it. Poetry in particular. And we're talking about a lot of things under poetry. The media of his day. Very much like art television. He says it creates a dream world. It creates a world where the idiosyncratic opinions of the poet actually work. In television, you could force the circumstance where the racist is humiliated and the diverse liberal group comes out on top. Well, you have full control of the production. So, of course, you can make that happen. And this is Plato's problem. Our television, movies, sitcoms, whatever, and music to a lesser extent, is not a bad parallel to what Plato meant by poetics. Entertainment today has no related, it is not realistic. It's not connected with us at all. I don't know anyone who functions like most of these characters do. Jews do not see the world the same way that Gentiles do. That was one of Willis Cardo's big things. And I think we'd be shocked about the ultimate difference. So they create a world specifically so that their particular ideology will work out. Because in the real world, it won't. They're selling a product. Again, Plato talks about rhetoric, poetics, aesthetics, essentially one thing. And really Aristotle, to be simplistic about it, because they're all aimed at some kind of persuasion, an imparting of some impression, one way or another, on very important issues. That's why Aristotle says for poetics, the issues have to be serious ones, or else it's a waste of time. In Greek, the term poetry comes from poiein, which is a very simple word. It means to make. It's constructed. Very much opposed. I mean, Aristotle rejected a lot of this. But philosophy is based on both reflection and discovery. Facts that exist independent of our minds. We have to conform ourselves to it. It's an objective reality whether we like it or not. So someone who has a problem with that, someone who believes in some variant of relativism, something like that, they're going to retreat into a poetic world that they have full control over. And Plato calls this inspired ignorance. I'm not so sure that you can have a good movie or even a great movie if the basic underlying features aren't true. Taxi Driver, great movie if you haven't seen it, Robert De Niro. It's true in the sense that that's what New York had become in just a space of 10 years, done in the 1970s. It was absolutely disgusting. Just 10, 15 years earlier, it wasn't like that. And the intense loneliness and alienation that Travis Bickle feels. There's a million examples of this. If it isn't true, and this is the problem with World War II movies. You know, it's based on mythology, and so it can't possibly be good entertainment. And mythology in the sense that it's false. I don't mean mythology in the ancient sense of the term. Now, in the Gorgias, I have an essay on that. I think it's on my website somewhere. And in that, Plato says there are two. You know, Gorgias was a sophist. A sophist is a rhetorician. Rhetoric was the domain of the sophist. And Plato hated them, as do I. The sophist was the journalist of the day. Journalism is very much what Plato means by poetry, because they create their own world all the time. So there's two kinds of persuasion. One is the one that we're used to. It's propaganda. It's meant to inculcate an opinion that really doesn't have much basis in reality. And if it's done enough time, people are just going to take it for granted as true. And the second is to promote true things rather than completely contrived things. But Plato will respond that rhetoric is not aimed at truth. And for the exact same reason, neither is journalism. Now, of course, journalism didn't exist at the time. That was always a muckraking thing in the progressive era. But they're similar. And I'll get to that here in just one second. He uses an example. He talks about the care of the body. Reality is medicine, exercise, controlled diet. That's an actual care of the body. But people who sell candy and processed foods and cosmetics. They might want you to think that that's taking care of your body, but it is not. It's covering over something. It's introducing poisons to your system. Now, in the Gorgias, Plato has it, or Socrates has it out with two people, Polus and Callicles. Polus says that happiness rests with the man who has power. This is what we want. We want power over others. Of course, for Plato, it was moral goodness, and he takes heat for that. Man with power is happiness. That means that, and of course, rhetoric has to be used to take power, to justify power. That means it's in opposition to the truth. The happy life is not connected to it whatsoever. In other words, does power equal being happy? It's an unexamined assumption. And Callicles then gets angry and says, no, power is about being able to reach all of your desires, to get whatever it is that you want. Callicles, in an early version of what Nietzsche would talk about later, says that these kind of morals, Plato, that you're talking about, these morals are just how the weak inhibit the strong. Power is a manly thing. It takes courage. Ideals are nothing but castles in the air. So he's a Machiavellian. Really a revolutionary. But remember, Athens at the time was in an advanced state of decay. It was a sea power. But Plato hits back that if power is gaining all your desires, as Callicles would say, that means power is freedom. Freedom is license. Rhetoric is a worldview. It's not just a tool. Now, here's the heart of the matter. One of his earliest dialogues is the Ion. And it's an attack on poetry. Poets, journalists, don't know what they're writing on. A journalist is not a specialist in the field that he's talking about. Economics, foreign policy. He is not particularly knowledgeable. He doesn't have to be particularly knowledgeable about it. Now, some journalists claim that they really know what's going on, but then they're subject to questioning by people who really do. The difference between a journalist and a scholar is between a philosopher and the sophist. And of course, they don't allow questioning anymore. Of course, they could deny. I mean, they could fully accept that we don't know what's going on, in which case, why the heck would we read you? So they have to maintain some kind of balance between the two. And Plato even mentions this about Homer and Hesiod. Was Homer an expert in the military arts? Or diplomacy? Because if truly he, and you know, Plato likes Homer. But if you truly speak beautifully about something, you have to know what you're talking about. It's not just a matter of stringing words together. You have to know all this if you are to speak well about it. So could the poet or journalist ever understand this kind of literature? None of them are experts. So if you claim to be an interpreter of a great thinker like Homer, that exegete needs to know all about what Hesiod talks or what Homer talks about. Military acts, things like piety, heroism. If Homer is truly beautifully describing things, then he must be an expert, whether it be military strategy or anything else. So sometimes they'll go and say, well, we know what people want. In other words, we know the soul. We know who we're talking to. We know what the population wants. Well, if that's the case, and if you know the soul, you have to fully understand reason, the connection between human nature and the cosmos around us, the soul's connection with reason and the forms. You have to know that too. The soul is a recapitulation of all of human experience and is parallel in the state. So you can't even say that. You don't know what people want. You mean what people want just because they're told to want something? Or what people want deep down? And how do you know the difference? All discourse, however, including the Platonic dialogue, has rhetorical elements. But Plato does say that the deliberate provoking of emotion, like Aristotle talks about in tragedy, the emotional appeals of rhetoric, that's rarely a good thing. So as Aristotle talks about mimesis as realism, imitating something that actually exists so that we can relate to it, Plato takes the word imitation as counterfeit. Imitation crab meat, not the actual thing. Because it comes down to interpretation of events or someone like Homer, but it's not based on anything. The point of a journalist is to capture an angle, to be a literary person, to keep the interest of the reader, to find an angle that, you know, people allegedly want. Of course, they don't say that, but that's really all they know how to do. And it's always been strange to me that 99% of the information that we get concerning, let's say, the situation in Ukraine are from people who don't know the first thing about Ukraine, Russia, modern warfare, or anything else. So it's very easy for the military to censor everything they do, which of course they do. Plato thinks that such a person is pandering to the crowd, or at least the crowd as they construct them. Plato hates all the false stories. He hates the myths that have come down to us about the gods. He hates it. They're not true. All they are is projections of how normal human beings are. Gods are the forms. The gods are just poetic descriptors of them. And he got in a lot of trouble for that. So if rhetoric and poetry is ever to be used, it has to be tightly connected to reason and philosophy. It has to promote the right emotions and impart the right lessons. So the idea, the form, the archetype, ultimate reality, philosophy. Underneath that, the artifact, the function of craftsmanship, looking at the form of the thing, all the angles, all the skill to create it. And that's, you know, the arts and sciences. And then finally, the lowest, imitation, which is just, you know, I mean, the craftsman knows something in his field. Philosopher knows something. The person who's merely imitating doesn't. What a journalist does is talk about foreign events as if they're, you know, the action movie trope, which they use for almost everything. They create characters, they create good guys and bad guys, and it's very clumsy. And when you don't know anything, you simply fill in the gaps with whatever you need. A friend of mine did an essay on, at least in contemporary cinema, The Descent into Madness, which you see all over the place, not just in reality, but in a lot of movies, dramas. And it's similar to Aristotle. The hero has a goal. He wants to be something. But there's something wrong with him. He's autistic in the very broad sense of the term. He doesn't sleep, he's lonely, he's isolated, he's very awkward. The chances of him, I don't know, let's say he wants to be a governor, or he wants to be a stand-up comedian or a famous musician. He doesn't have it. He certainly has the motivation, but he doesn't have the stability. He's in love with postmodern media. The simulacrum of a friend is better than a friend. He doesn't have friends. So he personalizes everything around him, including TV personalities. They want to be seen and heard, or at least feel they are. They want to live in the media life, this perfect life where everything goes the way we want. We have all the money and you know, significance we need. He doesn't want his own reality. He wants a new one. But then there's a collision. In his way to this goal, society doesn't deliver on its promises. Cliches like dream big, work hard and you'll get ahead, fail. And he fails. All the things that we're taught from birth up don't work out. And those are cliches. They're not realities. Good people don't prosper. Then they lash out, and they're rewarded for this. They lash out, and at least nothing happens to them. Travis Bickle, and Taxi Driver, kills the pimp, kills his bodyguard, and he's called a hero. Now, that's at the very end of it. But the Descent to Madness has to do with it. Violence somehow has a sanction on it. He can very quickly get things. But they're still sympathetic. They're not bad people. But we know that they have no chance of reaching their goal. And they have to live with that. They lose their jobs. They're alone. They're isolated. They have nobody. And this is where Aristotle would talk about the turn to misfortune. Because then they start to decay physically. I don't know if you've seen the Joker. Phoenix's, not the other one. I recommend you do it. It's far from perfect. But the reason that the critics slammed the Joker is that he is the white male. It's no accident that we use the clown makeup meme. But there's almost a physical transformation with a lot of these people. He stops caring. He's beyond depression at this point. If society doesn't want me the way I was, then I'll be someone new. And he stays social. They become their own worst enemy. A lot of maniacal laughter. Inappropriate comments. And again, we're still sympathetic because they haven't... None of this is their fault. This has all been forced on them. Then they fall into delusion. And this is where the collapse reaches its apogee. Reality is slipping away. Things like TV and TV characters are reality. Then there's a last straw. And in many cases, it's when their hero, the person that they model themselves after, and on their way to their goal, you know, a great musician or something like that, rejects them. Rejected by those who you have dedicated your life to. Those who you idolize. By this time, the old identity is gone. It's a full transformation. It could be a change of hair, change their name, change the way that they dress. No one wants them, so they're going to be someone else. And then the inevitable. They're going to eventually die. They can't keep this up. It's blatantly contradictory. None of this is really their fault. I mean, a lot of this is morally ambiguous. But this seems to be the general pattern. You see this in a few places. I know it best in The Joker. Their goal isn't necessarily all that terrible. In fact, it's not terrible at all. So they turn into what we call the villain. Starting off, actually, it's having more power than the hero. And the power doesn't seem to come from anything. This is something the Joker doesn't have. Darth Vader has it, though. But the villain is very motivated by something. He's driven. Driven far more strongly than the hero. And can be sympathetic. This is why in Star Wars, they did the prequels. Because Darth Vader just kind of shows up, and you don't know anything about him. You realize that he became that way for very good reason. Then you have a certain level of sympathy. The first Star Wars was poorly constructed because we have no backstory to any of these people. And what the villain does is expose the hero to hit him at his weakest point, not just the hero himself, but society as a whole. This is a far more detailed conception of what Aristotle was talking about with tragedy. And if you notice, quite often the villain wins for a while. The audience is uncomfortable. The villain uses creativity, and now the hero's on the defensive. Sometimes, in fact, the villain thinks he is the hero. He thinks he's right. He thinks he's doing the right thing. No one claims to be evil, unless there's this purely rhetorical. And this follows Aristotle's structure, which is, you know, it's a contemporary idea. So many of the villain stories. Now, when it comes to rhetoric and journalism, none of this really exists. The regime invents its enemies. It doesn't reflect them. It doesn't study Russia. It invents it. And these leaders that the regime hates are so one-dimensional and stupid. It's nothing but projection. They're projecting their worst tendencies onto others. It's a way they relieve themselves of any kind of guilt. Aristotle talks about comedy. And I think, and Aristotle doesn't say this, but it always comes at the expense of someone else. Comedy needs a victim. So self-deprecating humor, you are the victim. Rodney Dangerfield, David Letterman. They do this all the time. Failure, if it's deserved, can be funny. And the journalistic villain, you know, Saddam Hussein or Assad or Putin or whatever, me, you, they don't have normal characteristics. They are a bundle of negative properties. And I think I'll go to my grave saying that this is projection. This is a neurotic transference of their failures onto everyone else. And they have no conception. The regime has no conception of self-deprecation. The regime has no conception of humor. No establishment can be funny. Rebels can be funny. That's why the left can't mean. They're defenders of an official ideology of the American empire. They're never funny, partially because they don't have to be. There's a contradiction between some kind of reasonable expectation and reality. The unexpected. But ultimately, the villain can be funny if something like this happens. And funny in an actually humorous way. The villain is often mocking the hero, mocking the society that empowers him. Again, none of this is the case. Of course, the hero is the Jew, the American military. However you want, you know, the left. And they're seen as beyond reproach. Their enemies, however, are one-dimensional. But in order to be funny, all of these things have to have some relation to the truth. You can't parody somebody. You know, parodying is taking someone's foibles, let's say that's a part of their personality, and exaggerating it. Well, it has to really be there. In other words, you have to know who you're parodying. And Plato would say, only a musician could parody another musician. Otherwise, you don't know what you're doing. Concept of what's funny, the villain, insanity. To a great extent, this is how the regime deals with its own failures. The regime knows what the Joker is, or Michael Douglas in Falling Down. If you haven't seen that, I feel sorry for it. These aren't perfect people, but they're not one-dimensional either. This is another way of saying they know that we're not. They don't want their people to know that. It's kind of like the henchmen of the bad guy, like in James Bond. They're faceless, they're nameless, they get killed in huge numbers. They don't have families, they don't have friends. They're just sacrificed. That's the one-dimensional villain in the regime's world, politically speaking. Poetically, it's a very different story. There's a reason why, say, a husband who's forced through a divorce, loses his kids, lashes out, and beats the crap out of, I don't know, his wife or somebody. There's a reason for that. He didn't wake up that way. He was forced into it and felt that there was no way out. And even if there was, he'd be punished no matter what he does. That is not a one-dimensional villain. But True Crime Channels, which is almost exclusively a female concern, they will make it one-dimensional. You watch a true crime documentary, and I've done this, and you go and read through the discovery documents and the court documents, you will find that the true crime documentary bears no relation to the nature of these of what happened in the courtroom. It's an invention. I have an essay on John List, who killed his family a few weeks after I was born, up the street from me. They invented, I know the truth about the matter, but it makes him a complex figure, and propaganda doesn't do well with complexity. And I think Plato recognizes this completely. Poets, bereft of knowledge, have to create a caricature, not an actual person. It's different when in a fictional universe, you could sublimate. You know, maybe these guys have a point. We know that white males are killing themselves at huge numbers. We know no one cares. And they have to bury that understanding. You know, the propagandist knows that he's full of it. Only the minion thinks that he's right. The propagandist knows he isn't. Deep down, he knows this is pure self-interest. The hero can't be based on self-interest. Anyway, I think I've made my point here. These are aspects of how a society articulates itself. And the more alien that society is from the population, just like in Plato's time, although not nearly as extreme, the worse the poetics and the rhetoric are going to become. And this is the concept of mimesis, imitation, and interpretation. Thank you, everyone, again, for listening to me, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.